It's Patreon Cast!
Oh, Patreon Cast!
Yes, it's Patreon Cast with me, Mike Bennett.
Hello, patrons, and welcome to episode 2 of this Patreon Cast presentation of H.P. Lovecraft's The Thing on the Doorstep. But before we get into that, I'd just like to share with you a couple of items of news. Yes, I have a cold. Big deal, says you. Well, anyway, I picked it up from a woman sitting next to me on an airliner recently. I remember at the time thinking, as she was sitting next to me, sniffing and snuffling and coughing, why can't we be more like the Japanese and put those little white face masks on when we get onto trains and planes and into any kind of enclosed space with other non-infected people? And now that, of course, I have the cold myself, I'm faced with the same question. Should I now put on a little white face mask before I go out? Of course, you think, well, if I did, think of the looks I'd get. If I walked into a train station with a mask on, or an airport, God forbid, people would look at me like I was a hijacker or a bandit of some description. What I think we need is some kind of a campaign to try and normalise and encourage the wearing of masks and whatnot when we're, you know, sick with flu. I mean, think of the amount of money it would save in terms of days off that people have to take, you know, sick days. And, you know, the misery that everyone, you know, like, you know, when you get onto a train and it's like really crowded and there's no room and, you know, there's somebody sitting or you know, just next to you standing going in your face all the way to your destination. It's quite horrible. So I just think there should be some sort of campaign, you know. I do it myself, but what can I do? It really does need to be a kind of a governmental thing. A tagline might be, mask yourself and wear plastic gloves when you go out or when you have a cold, because then no one else will catch your virus. But that's not very catchy, is it? So let's try, how about, wrap up, snot face, keep your cold unto your plague-smitten self. Now that I like. And the reason why I was on that plane full of plague and snot was because I was returning from a trip to Ireland with my wife, because we'd been looking for a place to live. What's that, you cry? You're moving country again? But you only just moved back to the UK from Ireland a few years ago. And it's true, yes, we did. We moved back in 2011, after about 10 years in Ireland. And, you know, we've had a very nice 4 years here, but now we feel the time is right to go back again. My wife is from Ireland, as you know, and we have a lot of family and friends there, so, yeah, that's the plan. We move on the 3rd of November, and right now we have no permanent home to go to. We'll be staying with my in-laws for a bit until we can rent something of our own. What this means is that my output might be affected. Because obviously when I get to Ireland, I'm not going to have a place to write or record, or even upload for that matter, because my father-in-law's house doesn't have any kind of internet connection. They live in a completely internet-free house, which is probably quite nice, really, but not for me. Anyway, but what that means is if I want to upload something, I'll probably have to go into town and upload from the town library. But, you know, don't worry about it. I will get the next episode of Underground out to you next week before we go. And I'm confident that a normal service will be resumed very quickly, because we are going to rent a house as a matter of urgency. A house with a room for me to write and record and an internet connection for me to upload with. So fear not. It's all good for you. Just a bit turbulent for me. We're packing our stuff up this week. Ugh, I hate that, don't you? Oh well, what can you do? I'll keep you updated. And so, news over, we are now back to Arkham and H.P. Lovecraft's The Thing on the Doorstep. Remember last time the narrator is telling us the story of Edward Darby and his wife, Asenath. Asenath's father was Ephraim Waite, who lived in a half-decayed mansion in Innsmouth and had a reputation for being a powerful magician who could cause storms out at sea. Ephraim died insane just before Asenath entered the Hall School, where she met Edward. After the couple were married, Edward called upon the narrator, and he noticed that Edward seemed changed, more adult than before. He'd lost his boyish gaiety. But perhaps that's a good thing. Maturity, a sense of responsibility. And then Asenath brought some things to their home from Innsmouth, a vast supply of books and apparatus, and three servants, a very old couple who had been incredibly loyal to old Ephraim, and a swarthy young wench who had marked anomalies of feature and seemed to exude a perpetual odour of fish. The Thing on the Doorstep by H.P. Lovecraft. Read by Mike Bennett. Episode 2. For the next 2 years, I saw less and less of Darby. A fortnight would sometimes slip by without the familiar 3 and 2 strokes at the front door, and when he did call, or when, as happened with increasing infrequency, I called on him, he was very little disposed to converse on vital topics. He had become secretive about those occult studies which he used to describe and discuss so minutely, and preferred not to talk of his wife. She had aged tremendously since her marriage, till now, oddly enough, she seemed the elder of the two. Her face held the most concentratedly determined expression I have ever seen, and her whole aspect seemed to gain a vague, unplaceable repulsiveness. My wife and son noticed it as much as I, and we all ceased gradually to call on her, for which, Edward admitted in one of his boyishly tactless moments, she was unmitigatedly grateful. Occasionally the Darbys would go on long trips, ostensibly to Europe, though Edward sometimes hinted at obscure destinations. It was after the first year that people began talking about the change in Edward Darby. It was very casual talk, for the change was purely psychological, but it brought up some interesting points. Now and then, it seemed, Edward was observed to wear an expression and to do things wholly incompatible with his usual flabby nature. For example, although in the old days he could not drive a car, he was now seen occasionally to dash into or out of the old Crown and Shield driveway with Asenath's powerful Packard, handling it like a master and meeting traffic entanglements with a skill and determination utterly alien to his accustomed nature. In such cases, he seemed always to be just back from some trip or just starting on one. What sort of trip, no one could guess, although he mostly favoured the Innsmouth Road. Oddly, the metamorphosis did not seem altogether pleasing. People said he looked too much like his wife, or like old Ephraim Waite himself, in these moments. Or perhaps these moments seemed unnatural because they were so rare. Sometimes, hours after starting out in this way, he would return, listlessly sprawled on the rear seat of the car, while an obviously hired chauffeur or mechanic drove. Also, his preponderant aspect on the streets, during his decreasing rounds of social contacts, including, I may say, his calls on me, was the old-time indecisive one. Its irresponsible childishness, even more marked than in the past. While Asenath's face aged, Edward's, aside from those exceptional occasions, actually relaxed into a kind of exaggerated immaturity, save when a trace of the new sadness or understanding would flash across it. It was really very puzzling. Meanwhile, the Darbys almost dropped out of the gay college circle. Not through their own disgust, we heard, but because something about their present studies shocked even the most callous of the other decadents. It was in the third year of the marriage that Edward began to hint openly to me of a certain fear and dissatisfaction. He would let fall remarks about things going too far, and would talk darkly about the need of saving his identity. At first I ignored such references, but in time I began to question him guardedly, remembering what my friend's daughter had said about Azanath's hypnotic influence over the other girls at school, the cases where students had thought they were in her body, looking across the room at themselves. This questioning seemed to make him at once alarmed and grateful, and once he mumbled something about having a serious talk with me later. About this time, old Mr. Darby died, for which I was afterward very thankful. Edward was badly upset, though by no means disorganized. He had seen astonishingly little of his parents since his marriage, for Azanath had concentrated in herself all his vital sense of family linkage. Some called him callous in his loss, especially since those jaunty and confident moods in the car began to increase. He now wished to move back into the old Derby mansion, but Azanath insisted on staying in the Crown and Shield house, to which she had become well adjusted. Not long afterward, my wife heard a curious thing from a friend, one of the few who had not dropped the Derbys. She had been out to the end of the high street to call on the couple, and had seen a car shoot briskly out of the drive with Edward's oddly confident and almost sneering face above the wheel. Ringing the bell, she had been told by the repulsive wench that Azanath was also out, but had chanced to look up at the house in leaving. There, at one of Edward's library windows, she had glimpsed a hastily withdrawn face, a face whose expression of pain, defeat, and wistful hopelessness was poignant beyond description. It was, incredibly enough in view of its usual domineering cast, Azanath's. Yet the caller had vowed that in that instant the sad, muddled eyes of poor Edward were gazing out from it. Edward's calls now grew a trifle more frequent, and his hints occasionally became concrete. What he said was not to be believed even in centuried and legend-haunted Arkham, but he threw out his dark lore with a sincerity and convincingness which made one fear for his sanity. He talked about terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins in the heart of the main woods beneath which vast staircases led down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous exchanges of personality that permitted explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds and in different space-time continua. He would now and then back up certain crazy hints by exhibiting objects which utterly nonplussed me, elusively coloured and bafflingly textured objects like nothing ever heard of on Earth, whose insane curves and surfaces answered no conceivable purpose and followed no conceivable geometry. These things, he said, came from outside, and his wife knew how to get them, sometimes, but always in frightened and ambiguous whispers. He would suggest things about old Ephraim Waite, whom he had occasionally seen at the college library in the old days. These adumbrations were never specific, but seemed to revolve around some especially horrible doubt as to whether the old wizard were really dead, in a spiritual as well as corporeal sense. At times, Darby would halt abruptly in his revelations, and I wondered whether Azanath could possibly have divined his speech at a distance and cut him off through some unknown sort of telepathic mesmerism, some power of the kind she had displayed at school. Certainly she suspected that he told me things, for as the weeks passed, she tried to stop his visits with words and glances of a most inexplicable potency. Only with difficulty could he get to see me, for although he would pretend to be going somewhere else, some invisible force would generally clog his motions or make him forget his destination for the time being. His visits usually came when Azanath was away, away in her own body, as he once oddly put it. She always found out later, The servants watched his goings and comings, but evidently she thought it inexpedient to do anything drastic. Darby had been married more than 3 years on that August day when I got that telegram from Maine. I had not seen him for 2 months, but had heard he was away on business. Asenath was supposed to be with him, though watchful gossip declared there was someone upstairs in the house behind the doubly curtained windows. They had watched the purchases made by the servants, and now the town marshal of Chesuncook had wired of the draggled madman who stumbled out of the woods with delirious ravings and screamed to me for protection. It was Edward, and he had been just able to recall his own name and address. Chesuncook is close to the wildest, deepest, and least explored forest belt in Maine, and it took a whole day of feverish jolting through fantastic and forbidding scenery to get there in a car. I found Darby in a cell at the town farm, vacillating between frenzy and apathy. He knew me at once and began pouring out a meaningless and half-incoherent torrent of words in my direction.
"Dan, oh, for God's sake! The pit of the Shoggoths! Down the 6,000 steps! The abomination of abominations! I never would let her take me! And then I found myself there! Ia, Shub-Niggurath! The shape rose up from the altar, and there were 500 that howled! The hooded thing bleated! Camog! Camog! That was old Ephraim's secret name in the coven. I was there, where she promised she wouldn't take me. A minute before I was locked in the library, and then I was there, where she had gone with my body, in the place of utter blasphemy. The unholy pit where the black realm begins and the watcher guards the gate. I saw a Shoggoth. It changed shape. I can't stand it. I'll kill her if she ever sends me there again. I'll kill that entity. Her, him, it. I'll kill it. I'll kill it with my own hands.
It took me an hour to quiet him, but he subsided at last. The next day I got him decent clothes in the village and set out with him for Arkham. His fury of hysteria was spent, and he was inclined to be silent, though he began muttering darkly to himself when the car passed through Augusta, as if the sight of a city aroused unpleasant memories. It was clear that he did not wish to go home, and considering the fantastic delusions he seemed to have about his wife, delusions undoubtedly springing from some actual hypnotic ordeal to which he had been subjected, I thought it would be better if he did not. I would, I resolved, put him up myself for a time, no matter what unpleasantness it would make with Asenath. Later I would help him get a divorce, for most assuredly there were mental factors which made this marriage suicidal for him. When we struck open country again, Darby's muttering faded away, and I let him nod and drowse on the seat beside me as I drove. During our sunset dash through Portland, the muttering commenced again, more distinctly than before, and, as I listened, I caught a stream of utterly insane drivel about Asenath. The extent to which she had preyed on Edward's nerves was plain, for he had woven a whole set of hallucinations around her. His present predicament, he mumbled furtively, was only one of a long series. She was getting hold of him, and he knew that some day she would never let go. Even now, she probably let him go only when she had to, because she couldn't hold on long at a time. She constantly took his body and went to nameless places for nameless rites, leaving him in her body and locking him upstairs. But sometimes she couldn't hold on, and he would find himself suddenly in his own body again, in some far-off, horrible and perhaps unknown place. Sometimes she'd get hold of him again, and sometimes she couldn't. Often he was left stranded somewhere, as I had found him. Time and again he had to find his way home from frightful distances,
getting somebody to drive the car after he found it. The worst thing was that she was holding on to him longer and longer at a time. She wanted to be a man, to be fully human. That was why she had got hold of him. She had sensed the mixture of fine-wrought brain and weak will in him. Some day she would crowd him out and disappear with his body. Disappear to become a great magician like her father, and leave him marooned in that female shell that wasn't even quite human. Yes, he knew about the Innsmouth blood now. There had been traffic with things from the sea. It was horrible. And old Ephraim, he had known the secret, and when he grew old, did a hideous thing to keep alive. He wanted to live forever. Asenath would succeed. One successful demonstration had taken place already. As Darby muttered on, I turned to look at him closely, verifying the impression of change which an earlier scrutiny had given me. Paradoxically, he seemed in better shape than usual, harder, more normally developed, and without the trace of sickly flabbiness caused by his indolent habits. It was as if he had been really active and properly exercised for the first time in his coddled life, and I judged that Asenath's force must have pushed him into unwonted channels of motion and alertness. But just now his mind was in a pitiable state, for he was mumbling wild extravagances about his wife, about black magic, about old Ephraim, and about some revelation which would convince even me. He repeated names which I recognised from bygone browsings in forbidden volumes, and at times made me shudder with a certain thread of mythological consistency, or convincing coherence, which ran through his maundering. Again and again he would pause, as if to gather courage for some final and terrible disclosure. Dan, don't you remember him? Wild eyes and the unkempt beard that never turned white. He glared at me once, and I never forgot it. Now, she glares that way, and I know why. He found it in the Necronomicon, the formula, and I don't dare tell you the page yet, but when I do, you can read and understand. Then you will know what has engulfed me. On, 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 body to body to body. He means never to die. The life glow, he knows how to break the link. It can flicker on a while, even when the body is dead. I'll give you hints, and maybe you'll guess. Listen, Dan, do you know why my wife always takes such pains with that silly back handwriting? Have you ever seen a manuscript of old Ephraim's? Do you want to know why I shivered when I saw some hasty notes Asenath had jotted down? Asenath, is there such a person? Why did they half think there was poison in old Ephraim's stomach? Why do the Gilmans whisper about the way he shrieked like a frightened child when he went mad and Asenath locked him up in the padded attic room where the other had been? Was it old Ephraim's soul that was locked in? Who locked in whom? Why had he been looking for months for someone with a fine mind and a weak will? Why did he curse that his daughter wasn't a son? Tell me, Daniel Upton, what devilish exchange was perpetrated in the house of horror where that blasphemous monster had his trusting, weak-willed, half-human child at his mercy? Didn't he make it permanent, as she'll do in the end with me? Tell me why that thing that calls itself Asenath writes differently off guard, so that you can't tell its script from... Then the thing happened. Darby's voice was rising to a thin, treble scream as he raved, when suddenly it was shut off with an almost mechanical click. I thought of those other occasions at my home when his confidences had abruptly ceased, when I had half fancied that some obscure telepathic wave of Asenath's mental force was intervening to keep him silent. This, though, was something altogether different, and, I felt, infinitely more horrible. The face beside me was twisted almost unrecognisably for a moment, while through the whole body there passed a shivering motion, as if all the bones, organs, muscles, nerves and glands were adjusting themselves to a radically different posture, set of stresses and general personality. Just where the supreme horror lay I could not for my life tell. Yet there swept over me such a swamping wave of sickness and repulsion, such a freezing, petrifying sense of utter alienage and abnormality, that my grasp of the wheel grew feeble and uncertain. The figure beside me seemed less like a lifelong friend than like some monstrous intrusion from outer space, some damnable, utterly accursed focus of unknown and malign cosmic forces. I had faltered only a moment, but before another moment was over, my companion had seized the wheel and forced me to change places with him. The dusk was now very thick, and the lights of Portland far behind, so I could not see much of his face. The blaze of his eyes, though, was phenomenal, and I knew that he must now be in that queerly energized state, so unlike his usual self, which so many people had noticed. It seemed odd and incredible that listless Edward Darby, he who could never assert himself and who had never learned to drive, should be ordering me about and taking the wheel of my own car. Yet that was precisely what had happened. He did not speak for some time, and in my inexplicable horror, I was glad he did not. In the lights of Biddeford and Saco, I saw his firmly set mouth, and shivered at the blaze of his eyes. The people were right. He did look damnably like his wife, and like old Ephraim when in these moods. I did not wonder that the moods were disliked. There was certainly something unnatural in them, and I felt the sinister element all the more because of the wild ravings I had been hearing. This man, for all my lifelong knowledge of Edward Pickman Darby, was a stranger, an intrusion of some sort from the black abyss. The music you're listening to is by Kevin MacLeod. Find out more at incomptech.com.
Oops.
Asenath. It's a hard name to say. Asenath's father was Ephraim Waite. Asenath's father was Ephraim Waite. Asenath's father was... Asenath's... I can't do it. Asenath's father was Ephraim Waite.
Goodbye from Patreon cast. These trousers are too tight. I need to get cut out of them now.
This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you and all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution.
I
did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.